Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. This recording, made on March 7th, 2015, at the Portland Public Library, is the culminating event in the 3-year local and legendary Maine in the Civil War project. This project was run by the Maine Humanities Council and Maine Historical Society, with funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities. We join David Blight for The Civil War in American Memory, Legacies in Our Time. One of the most renowned Civil War scholars in the country, David Blight is a professor of American history at Yale University and the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale.
Thank you, Hayden, and thank you, Steve. First of all, I want to say something about public libraries. I know this is a cliche, you hear this here a lot, but I love public libraries. I grew up in a public library. I was saying this at dinner. I used to spend every afternoon between 3 and 5 o'clock in the Flint Public Library, waiting for my mother to get off work across the street so I could get a ride home. There's just no place like public libraries. And if they ever go away, then the rest of us should just give it up and quit. Okay, I want to talk tonight primarily about this question of the legacies of this event, this not just the war, but the whole epic of the Civil War in our own time, now. And I'm going to go through in just a couple of minutes my own kind of evolving list of reasons why I think, and you can add to this in the Q&A, reasons why this event still has a hold on us, still has a grab on our imagination, still sits somewhere at the center of our memory. And I will say it's, you know, finally the sesquicentennial of the Civil War is over. I suppose I shouldn't say finally, but this April's finally over, and there were so many endings of the Civil War in April, hinder and yon, and I was at a number of them, that it's now May and it ought to be. The war's over everywhere but in Maine, as I said to a friend the other day. And I'm going to Maine on Thursday to get it over with. But frankly, and seriously, we've always wanted to get it over with, haven't we? We want that war to be over. We really want it to finally just be quiet. Sit still. Just be done. On the morning after Barack Obama was elected president the first time, in 2008, the morning after, on November 5 of 2008, in his column in the New York Times, Thomas Friedman, famous columnist for the Times and very good columnist for the Times, wrote a column, as everyone had to that day, about somehow the meaning of the election of Barack Obama. He called the editorial, and God knows at what hour of the middle of the night and under what condition Tom Friedman wrote this piece, but it's what columnists do, right? They come up with great topic sentences, and then somehow the rest of the column will just take care of itself, right? That's what you do when you write columns. But that topic sentence he wrote was, quote, and by the way, entitled the piece, Finishing Our Work. But it read, quote, and so it came to pass. Little King James language there. And so it came to pass that on November 4, 2008, shortly after 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Grant Park, Chicago, Illinois, the American Civil War ended. As, I'm still quoting, a black man, Barack Hussein Obama, won enough electoral votes to become President of the United States. Now, I can remember, I've studied memory a lot, and if I know nothing else, I know never trust your memory. But I do remember when I read that morning in whatever state I was in, I remember thinking, God, what if he's right? They won't need me anymore. They won't need Patrick Rail. They won't need us. I thought, God, this is bad for business. But then I think I remember, my next thought quickly, I hope, was, what a silly thing to say. What an absurd thing to say. The Civil War ended last night. Really? But now, on the other hand, and in the column, by the way, Friedman goes on to invoke the Battle of Gettysburg, and he links it to how the electoral votes of Pennsylvania had put Obama over the top. And I mean, he was really wearing it out. I mean, but that's okay. But then, you know, if you think about it, Friedman was perhaps representing something deep in our culture, deep in our history, deep in our memory. Can't we just finally declare that war over, declare its issues over, declare its biggest issue over? And in that moment of hyperbole, and that morning after, a lot of us were writing topic sentences, right? A lot of us were weeping our topic sentences. Perhaps 52% of the country was weeping for one reason and 48% were weeping for another, but we were weeping topic sentences. Something really extraordinary had happened, or certainly so it seemed. We want that war to just finally end. You know, at what point, over which horizon, around what bend, over what hill are we ever going to finally be able to declare it's over? Appomattox. The verdicts of Appomattox are finally done. Right? Don't we crave that? Don't we crave that often about a lot of things in history? The biggest, most vexing, terrible, and triumphant turning points out of the past. We yearn for that time when we can say, we can put that to rest. Or, its time has come to put it at rest. Or, you know, think of the language we use. Get over it. It. You know, and Friedman may, you know, he may not have thought that long about it, because as a columnist he had to knock this piece out, you know, at 2 a.m. in 20 minutes. So, he didn't get to reflect that long on it. But he may have been reflecting something very deep in all of it. Go back to Walt Whitman, our great death poet. Our great Civil War poet, along with Melville and a few others. But in 1882, in Specimen Days, Whitman was yearning to get that war over too, in his own soul, which he never could. But he wrote that incredible line when he said, "And so goodbye to the war. I know not how it may have been or may be to others. To me, the main interest I found, and still on recollection find, in the rank and file of the armies on both sides, and in those specimens amid the hospitals, and even the dead on the field." And as you know, I mean, Whitman spent, what, 3 full years of the war working as a nurse in those Washington, D.C. hospitals. The sheer number of soldiers that he nursed, or helped, or talked to their deaths is extraordinary. He never got the Civil War out of his craw, out of his soul. Neither did Melville. Neither did millions of others who experienced it. And maybe we never really have either. Even if we are not always aware of it. Now, for the students present, who, they didn't leave, did they? No, there they are. We just had a great session back there in that room for 20 minutes and more with the, is it Livermore School? Livermore? Is it? I'm sorry, what? It's called what? What's your school called again? Thank you. I didn't want to blow it there, but I did, didn't I? It was great. They spent the entire year studying the Civil War, and particularly through a main family, the Washburn. And we were in this great discussion. About what they learned and their take homes. And right when they asked me what I thought about reenactors, it was time to come up here. Actually, I have great respect for reenactors. But seriously, this is for you. I want to begin with two of my favorite writers. I wrote about them in a recent book called American Oracle, which is about four writers at the time of the Civil War centennial in the 1950s and 60s. Robert Penn Warren, Bruce Catton, Edmund Wilson, and James Baldwin, and to a certain extent, Ralph Ellison, whom I'll come back to briefly at the end tonight. But this is for you. James Baldwin. If you haven't read Baldwin yet, you should have your citizenship revoked within a year if you don't start reading Baldwin. That's just my useless opinion. But Baldwin became at that point, young African-American writer of fiction first, but then of great nonfiction essays in the 1950s and 60s. He became the kind of written voice of the civil rights movement. But though Baldwin rarely wrote directly about the Civil War per se, but he was always writing about the legacies of slavery and the legacies of emancipation and the legacies of that war's results. He was always writing about that. And if any of you know Baldwin or you've read Baldwin or if you ever saw an interview with Baldwin, and he did hundreds, if not thousands, of interviews in the 60s, especially after he became so famous with his famous pamphlet, The Fire Next Time, 1963, he was always doing interviews. And Baldwin, being the angry young man that he was, even as he got older, he was an angry young man, he would often just answer questions before they were asked, especially if his interviewer was white and a liberal. But he was once being interviewed by the great Studs Terkel. Some of you will remember Studs. He was in Chicago all of his life, I think, but he was the great oral historian. He wrote oral history after oral history about everything, from World War II to work and many other things. But he interviews Baldwin in 1962, and he's interviewing Baldwin, and Baldwin is just firing away at Terkel, and he's saying, Americans have no sense of history. They don't know anything about their past. If history hit them in the eye, they wouldn't know it. And Americans don't have any sense of tragedy. They don't have any sense of the past. And finally, Terkel says, Mr. Baldwin, slow down. What do you mean by a sense of history? And what do you mean by a sense of tragedy? And you can almost sense Baldwin pausing for 20 seconds, thinking a bit. And here was his answer to the, what is the sense of history? He says, well, you read something that you thought only happened to you, and you discover that it happened 100 years ago to Dostoevsky. This is a great liberation for the suffering, struggling person who always thinks he is alone. That was his answer. And I think especially when you're young, and you hear us teachers all the time proselytizing and telling you, you should have a sense of the past. Know your history. Your parents tell you, well, I hope your parents tell you that. And you sometimes probably wonder, well, what do they mean? Having a sense of the past, Baldwin's saying, is simple. It's just knowing you're not alone. That whatever may happen to you, whatever may happen to you, has probably happened before. That can be sobering. It can be devastating when it happens. But then Terkel pushed him and said, so what do you mean by a sense of tragedy, these Americans who don't have any sense of tragedy? Baldwin paused a bit and gave this answer. Quote, people think that a sense of tragedy is a kind of embroidery, something irrelevant, that you can take or leave. But in fact, it's a necessity. That's what the blues and the spirituals are all about. It is the ability to look on things as they are and to survive your losses, or even not survive them. To know that your losses are coming, to know they are coming, is the only possible insurance you have that you will survive them. What does it mean to have a sense of tragedy? Baldwin's answer is, it's knowing enough history, it's knowing enough of human experience, it's exploring human experience enough to know that loss is always a part of that experience. always. And the only way you can ever be prepared for them is to study it. And I think you can apply what he meant there probably on an individual level to the collective, to the social, and to the national. And in America, we're not good about tragedy. I don't even like the word. And Robert Penn Warren, I can't give a lecture at all about the legacies of the Civil War without invoking him. I hear you did a Faulkner weekend here, which I think is fantastic. Faulkner in Maine, who would have thought it? That's fantastic. But I've already suggested to Steve that you now need to do a Robert Penn Warren weekend. Warren in Maine. Yeah, it doesn't have the same ring, I guess. Robert Penn Warren, the southern-born, Kentucky-born poet, novelist, essayist, writer, historian, thinker, who lived an amazing trajectory in his life to, in so many ways, overcome the racism and the lost cause in which he was so steeped as a child, sitting at the feet of his Confederate veteran grandfather, Gabriel Penn, who spun yarn after yarn after yarn at him as a little boy, just outside Guthrie, Kentucky. But Warren will live to win three Pulitzers, two in poetry and one in fiction, to write All the King's Men, which I think is right up there with Invisible Man and maybe a couple others, is the greatest American novel of the 20th century. But he also, by 1960, was so prominent as a kind of Southern voice, but a Southern voice who had now moved north. Warren spent the last 40 years of his life at Yale University. He and C. Van Woodward used to exchange lots of notes and letters about what it was like to live among all the Yankees. They said that in private all the time. Warren used to complain that these Yankees had long red lights. I didn't know that was a Yankee thing. But in 1960, he's asked by Life magazine to write this essay that he then published first in Life magazine and then as a pamphlet. It's barely 100 pages. It's called Legacy of the Civil War. And I think it is still the place to start. If you want to read about the memory of the American Civil War, and you want to start with one text, a lot of other places to go, including Faulkner's fiction, but start with Robert Penn Warren's Legacy of the Civil War. There are so many quotable lines in that book, but my favorite is the one where he says, and we can chew on this, he says, the Civil War is our oracle. And by our, it's that kind of imperial hour of Americans. The Civil War is our oracle, darkly unriddled and portentous, of national as well as personal fate. He goes on to say many other things. He says, we have the Civil War in our bones. He says it reaches in a, quote, a thousand ways into our bloodstream and into our personal present. Now, that's 1960-61. That's 55 years ago. It may not be the same now, and we need to acknowledge that. Collective memory, social memory, historical memory is never static. It never stays put. It's never the same thing, especially from one generation to the next. But for Robert Penn Warren, it was the defining experience through which he saw essentially everything. If the Civil War was and is a kind of oracle, you know, a place we go, a subject we go to, a moment in the past we invoke to ask the great questions, like, who are we? What is an American? What is this place? What is this republic? If it is an oracle, where is it? If you're here tonight for a lecture on the legacies of the Civil War, the Civil War may, for some of you, be a kind of oracle. Maybe you've been reading about it all of your life, like I have. Why? I'm sure there are other subjects you've read about all of your life, too. But if the Civil War is our oracle, then where is it? It could be a place. Easily, it could be a place. It might be Cemetery Ridge at Gettysburg. Or for Mainers, it might be a little Round Top because of Joshua Chamberlain. I had to get that in there. Or, you know, or it might be Monument Avenue in Richmond. It might be Stone Mountain in Georgia. Although that's mostly an amusement park, you know. It might be the Shaw Memorial in Boston Common. Anyway, the Oracle can be a lot of places. The Shaw Memorial is certainly one for me. Augustus St. Gaudens' masterpiece. Masterpiece of art, much less of history. It may be the Lincoln Memorial. I mean, most prominently, it may be the Lincoln Memorial. Unveiled in 1922. The Lincoln Memorial, if we have one, is America's secular temple. Everybody goes there to use it. Every political persuasion has appropriated it. The Ku Klux Klan has rallied around it. The Communist Party has rallied around it. Everybody has. We associate it now so iconically with Martin Luther King's dream speech, but there have been thousands of other speeches from those steps. And if you go to the Lincoln Memorial, what do there? You walk up inside. You try to find some way to drown out the din of the seventh graders inside there with you on a field trip. And you look at the words. That's all that's there. I mean, there's the big fellow himself, but it's just words from three speeches. Is that our oracle? I don't know. You know, your oracle may be a verse in a Whitman poem. It may be, I don't know. It could be a Frederick Douglass passage. But there's something about this event that we go to and we want it to give us answers to questions. We sometimes have the questions and the answers all figured out. All right, I want to go through my little list here. And I'm going to try to do it quickly. And then in the Q&A, you can add to the list and you can challenge my list. Why does this event still have a hold on us? We've just been through this 150th anniversary season. And we can come back to just what kind of a sesquicentennial we had at either the national or the state level. And frankly, most of what happened happened at the state level. There really was no national sesquicentennial of the Civil War. The closest thing is really what did happen in the National Park Service at a place like Appomattox 2 weeks ago, or at Gettysburg in July of 2013, or at Fort Sumter in the spring of 2011, and so forth. But we had no national commission and no congressional attention and, frankly, no presidential White House attention to this event. And there may be real reasons for that. We were all waiting for President Obama to give some kind of major speech at the 150th anniversary of emancipation, January 1st of 2013. That's ancient history now, I know, but you may forget that that very day, the government was on the brink of government shutdown. And it would have been pretty bad form for the president to hold some major event, as the government shutting down. Irony is a good thing, but too much can overdo it. But it has a hold on us. This event still has a hold on us. It has a hold on us in publishing. It has a hold on us in documentary filmmaking. It has a hold on us. Why? Just some suggestions. One, demographics. About one-third of all Americans, what are there, 320 million of us? About one-third of us, something over 100 million, can trace our ancestors directly to someone in the Civil War. Black and white, South and North, West and every region, if we choose to. Now, that doesn't mean everybody does. But one-third of us had people in that event. People in an event that was a Civil War, that tore the society apart. And as a lot of you in this room surely know, the Civil War is still very much a family affair. Maybe more so in the South than in parts of the North, although I'm not so sure of that anymore. In this world of genealogy now, it's a family affair for people everywhere. And I'm not sure I understood that entirely until I was doing research on Bruce Catton. Bruce Catton, as some of you know, was was the great narrative historian of the 1950s and 60s. He wrote, he had more readers than anyone ever for this event. He wrote 18 books in 22 or 24 years. He was the first historian that I knowingly ever read. And I've come completely out of the closet as a fan of Bruce Catton's. In the big time academy where I have to live most of the time, you got to be careful where you say that, you know, because he was a popular historian. But all right, show of hands. How many of you have read at least one Bruce Catton book? Oh, God, I'm in heaven. Bruce left papers in two places, voluminous personal papers, that so far as I can tell, no one had ever used. One batch is at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina, ironically for such a Yankee historian as he was in some ways. But most of his papers are in Laramie, Wyoming, because that's where the American Heritage Archive is. Anyway, if you want to do research on Bruce Catton, you got to go spend at least a week in Laramie, and that may be why no one's... It's a Holiday Inn in the same steakhouse for 10 days. That's terrible. I have nothing against Wyoming. But in Bruce Catton's paper, among many other wonderful things, are thousands of fan letters. I mean, this guy had readers. I mean, most of us hope to live to have 10 letters or 5, you know, and not be by our relatives, you know, of the kind he would get. It was unbelievable. And so many of those letters invoked the fact that they were reading about this because of their family. Catton would get letters, especially in the 50s, and it would say, "Mr. Catton, I love your books. Can't wait for the next one. I read them slowly," on and on and on they would go. And then they would say something like, this is very common. They would say, "On page 82 of Stillness at Appomattox, you quote a diary from a man in the 37th New York Volunteers. That's my grandfather." Once in a while, it'll say, "That was my father." And if you do the math, that's still possible, entirely possible, in the 50s. One guy writes to him and says, "I had 9 great uncles in the Civil War, 5 on one side and 4 on the other. And you only quoted from 2 of them." So, you know, I don't know for sure that he had the 9. Who knows if he did, but he may not have even had them, but by then he believed it. He told that story so many times. It's a family affair. That's one of the reasons we're always drawn back to this. And that may erode with time, especially with the kind of immigrant country we are now. Except those of us who teach about this know that it doesn't necessarily require a family connection. I still remember the Korean-American immigrant kid who walked into my office at Amherst College and started talking to me about the Civil War like he was this bona fide Civil War buff. I said, "Where did you grow up?" He said, "St. Paul, Minnesota." I said, "But you were born in Korea?" "Yeah, we came when I was an infant." I said, "Why are you so interested in this? Your family clearly wasn't here." But he had the greatest of all answers. He said, "Well, because it's so important." I said, "Teacher, that's the greatest thing you can ever hear." I said, don't say another word, my child. Just believe that. Just listen to me and believe that. You know, it's like, 2, we're drawn back to this event because of loss. Think about it. When we need to compare loss, loss in war, loss in catastrophe like 9/11, which is also war. 9/11 was an act of war, but it was also a kind of human catastrophe. Whenever we face loss, or we face loss around the globe, our comparison is the Civil War. We've never experienced loss on that scale since, and hope to God we never do. The official count of the Civil War dead, some of you are aficionados, and I'm sure you know all this. The official count of the Civil War dead for many, 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 many decades was 620,000 Americans. Both sides died in the war. Decided majority of them from disease and not from battle wounds, but 620,000. But because of an article written by an economic historian named David Hacker about 3 years ago now, published in a scholarly journal that 30 or 40 of us probably read, he did an intensive computer analysis of the Civil War dead, particularly of the census data. And he came up with conclusions, to make a long story short, I won't go into his methodology because I don't entirely understand it. He came up with the conclusion that we are at least 100,000 low on that official count, especially of Confederate war dead. And his conclusions show that we should be living with a 700,000 to 750,000 figure. If you buy his research, and I think he does have a few critics, but most people have not found any way to refute him, and you came forward to the Vietnam War era per capita, you take the 1860s and compare it to the 1960s, there'd be somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 million names on the Vietnam Memorial. That's the scale of loss to the 1860s versus the scale of, we have 60,000 dead in Vietnam, and that war tore our society apart. Imagine a war that we don't want to imagine a war in which we would experience loss on that scale. We're drawn to loss if we're serious. And I noted that the student's course ended with Drew Faust's recent book, The Republic of Suffering, which is a deep, dark study of death in the Civil War. We finally got to the real. The real stuff about the Civil War in the last decade or so. Why do we call Whitman our death poet? Because he could never stop writing about it. The dead, said Whitman, the dead, the dead, the dead, our dead, or south, or north, ours, all. Three. There are a lot of ways to put this, but the simplest way is we're drawn to this event because it's an epic. In that old-fashioned sense of the word, when we hear the word epic, we might often think of epic movies. David Lean, Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, I don't know. I don't know what you think of when you think of that word epic. But epic in the old-fashioned sense, a great story that has heroes and villains, probably a good deal of melodrama, a beginning, a middle, and some kind of ending. And the Civil War is an epic. And sometimes we ought to just be honest. We're probably drawn to it because it is one hell of a story. All those books, thousands and thousands of books people keep writing about this event, some of which are worth reading. And stop and think about it a moment. That epic, what is it? Well, it's the story of this republic founded in the late 18th century out of the Age of Revolution and Enlightenment ideologies, an amazing little republic that fights a revolution against the greatest empire in the world and somehow wins, creates a constitution, which is an incredibly rare thing in the world, very flawed constitution, but they did it. And 80-some years into its life, it tears itself to pieces over the second largest system of human slavery on the planet, second only to Russian serfdom. It fights an all-out civil war, the largest war in modern history to that moment in time, and then it has to put itself all back together again. That's the stuff of epic. We can make that epic into sheer romance, which we do. We're really good at that. We did it so much in our cultural memory of the war. Or we can study it for its epic qualities, or we can tell a different kind of epic. How about the epic of emancipation? The liberation of 4 million people from slavery practically overnight in historical time is an epic. It's not all clean and pretty, but it's an amazing story. So, we're drawn to it because it's an amazing story. Four. And by the way, God, did Bruce Kapman, half your hands went up, you already know this, but did Bruce Kapman understand that this story was an epic? Could that guy write a topic sentence? He wrote sentences that just drew you in. Here's one little example. Permit me, forgive me. the non-Bruce Catton readers in here, get a Catton book by Saturday. This is Catton describing the moment in August, September 1862, Lee's first invasion of the North. And you know where he's going with it. It's, of course, Antietam and the big turning point of the war and emancipation. But here's how Catton captures it. Quote, "There was nobility in the idea that there ought to be a peace without victory. Yet in August of 1862, America's tragedy was that it was caught between the madness of going on with the war and the human impossibility of ever stopping it. Neither Mr. Lincoln nor Mr. Davis was going to assume anything of the kind. Each man was fighting for a dreadful simplicity. Neither one could describe a solution acceptable to him without describing something wholly unacceptable to the other. Neither man could accept anything less than complete victory without admitting complete defeat. Both sides had heard the trumpet that could never call retreat. The peacemakers could not be heard, and the terrible swift sword had been sheathed, but the scabbard had been thrown away, and the Confederacy was carrying the war into the enemy's territory." You just got to keep reading. Also, Bruce Catton's the only author I know of who could use three passages from the Battle Hymn of the Republic, fold them into his own prose, and get away with it. Who else would even try? Sheathing swords and terrible swift swords. You don't, you can't. If one of my graduate students wrote a paragraph like that, I'd forget it. Just give it back to me. Four. Or is it five? Five, good. Modernity. I know, that's a wildly elusive concept, but how many times do you hear or read that somehow a modern America was born out of the Civil War? That's true. Now, exactly what we mean by modern is always open to debate, but think of it at least this way. There is no question that out of this war came, if we're talking legacies, here's one of the biggest and most enduring. That war, of necessity, forged the first great modern centralized federal state. The United States government, the federal government, had been a pretty small and weak thing until the Civil War. About the only major agencies it ever had was an army, and a pretty small one, except at the time of the Mexican War, and a post office, and at times a navy. It didn't tax anybody for anything before the war. But what did that Lincoln administration do? The first Lincoln administration, the first Republicans, not to be confused with our current ones, if you don't mind. A little fact. But what did that first Republican Party do in the war? They created the first income tax in 1862, and you would love to have those rates. They were really low, but there'd never been an income tax. They created a finance system, the greenback dollar, and a deal they cut with Jay Cook and those New York bankers to create something called U.S. bonds, which paid for the war. They invested citizens in buying into the war. It was risky. It wasn't clear this thing was going to work, but it really worked. You bought bonds, you bought the Union cause. That finance system was very political, but it worked. What else did they create? The Homestead Act. Homestead Acts have been laying around for a long time in Congress. This idea, go west, this dream, go west, cordon off a little piece of land. You work it for a year or two, and it's yours. I mean, if there was something you could call the American dream in the 1840s and 1850s, what was it? It was go west, get some land, work it, and gain mobility. That Homestead Act was an amazing dream come true for so many people. What else did they do? They created the Morrill Act. Justin Morrill, he's a Vermonter. That was the bill, among other things, that created land-grant colleges. I went to Michigan State, which still claims it was the original land-grant college, but I know Cornell does, and about six other places do, and they probably all were created in the same 3 months. But by God, at Michigan State, we grew up believing that old MAC, as it was called, Michigan Agricultural College, was the original Morrill Land Grant College. These were colleges to train farm boys and clerks and whatever they were doing to do something better at public expense. What else did they do? The Transcontinental Railroads. They authorized and began to... Now that, of course, will turn into perhaps the single most corrupt arrangement between the federal government and taxpayers' money and corporate America ever imagined, although we've come close to it many other times. I mean, it's the model. Amazing skullduggery, amazing corruption, but they linked the coast. This dream of the railroad crossing the entire continent, they imagined that and they did that. What else did they do? They created something called the Quartermaster Corps, which doesn't sound sexy at all. But it was this huge agent. Nothing like this had ever existed. It hardly even existed in anyone's imagination. But as the war developed into its second year, and by the third year it was costing $2.5 million a day to fight it, and requiring hundreds of thousands of pairs of shoes and uniforms and millions of mini balls and guns and cannon of all kind, they created this agency to cut all the contracts between the federal government and all those mill towns all over New England and all over the North to produce the material to win the Civil War. I always tell my students at Yale that the Civil War was won in New Haven, in those old mills that are now being converted into either condos or high-tech companies, or they're sitting there empty. The Quartermaster Corps, by 1864, employed 100,000 people, which made it the second largest employer in the United States, second only to the Union Army. This was big government. And it was big government to fight a war. And last but not least, that big government emancipated the slaves. It engaged in the largest confiscation of property ever, at least in American history. And try to imagine any confiscation on that scale again. What would it be? They confiscated approximately $3.5 billion worth of slaves in 2 years. That's what slaves were worth in 1860. The single largest asset in the entire American economy were slaves. I'll repeat that. The single largest asset in the entire... They were worth more than all manufacturing, all railroads, everything put together except the land. Take the largest single asset in the American economy today and imagine the government confiscating it. We'd have more than one Tea Party. We'd all be in a Tea Party. That's modernity. It isn't always pretty. It could be very ugly. But it did great things and some not so great. So if we want to understand where that modernity comes from, especially about government, in all of our endless debates over the nature of government, the function of government, the relationship of the states to the federal government, about big government, I get so tired of our debate about big government, as though that's only it's only something we've had for 30 years, or 40, or some people take it back to the New Deal, and they keep trying to kill whatever's left of the New Deal. Big government came from the original Republican Party in the Civil War. Sixth, unity. Why are we drawn to this story? Because sometimes we choose, and not for bad reasons, I understand. We love the post-war unity story that comes out of it. Yes, we fought in Armageddon. Yes, we had one hell of a civil war. Yes, we experienced terrible loss. But we survived. We reinvented ourselves somehow. And we became a great power. And that's quite a story. We like that unification, reunification, reconciliation, reunion story. I wrote a book called Race and Reunion, which is about this messy, complicated problem of how a country puts itself back together after such a divisive experience, such a bloody divisive experience, such a violent experience. Sometimes that's the only part of this war a lot of people want. We love being the country that survived the Civil War, not that caused it. We love being the country that freed the slaves, not the country that owned slaves. Not the country that was founded in that power of the ownership of slaves. That built its constitution out of devotion to slavery. We don't want to be that country. We wanted that country destroyed. And in a sense, it's kind of what Lincoln said at Gettysburg, didn't he? Or he's trying to imagine that at Gettysburg. You've all read the Gettysburg Address. You probably could recite it. But what did he actually say? What did he mean? Well, in the middle of that speech is his metaphor of rebirth. And where's he giving the speech? In a cemetery of the dead at Gettysburg, half of whom aren't even really buried yet. He's saying in so many words in the Gettysburg Address, and this is open to interpretation, I understand, but part of what I think he's saying is, my friends, we are burying the first American Republic here, and we have to create a second one, a new one, a better one, a reborn one. And after all, in the opening line of the speech, he mouthed the word equality, even if he didn't know precisely where that was supposed to go. Seventh, it was our first racial reckoning. Every time we have another racial reckoning, whether that was at the turn of the 20th century with all the problems of the Jim Crow system and lynching and the resistance movements against it like in the NAACP and others, or whether that's in the post-World War II era when the Civil Rights Revolution breaks out finally in the 1950s and transforms the United States by the mid-60s in the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Acts and so many other enactments. Beginning with Brown v. Board at the Supreme Court level, that was a massive racial reckoning. And we're having another one. We don't know where it's going. We don't even know what to call it yet. Since last August, we've been having one after another problem of police community. You know, the nice way of putting it is a problem with police community relations. We have a lot of dead black men at the hands of police now. Police have terrible, difficult jobs, God knows. And we're learning, maybe we're learning a lot about that usefully, of what it means to be a cop in this country. But we're having a racial reckoning again. And any time we do, whenever we have our racial reckonings, this is our template. We have to go back to this. We have to go back not just to the war, but to Reconstruction. And you can hope, if you care about this, you can hope that in the next few years, as we have all those anniversaries of Reconstruction, if anyone's paying attention, if anyone's listening, when we have all these conferences on the 14th Amendment and the first Civil Rights Acts and the 15th Amendment after that, when we try to commemorate Reconstruction, maybe we'll really, really then examine what a racial reckoning the Civil War was. And then last, I think that's eight or is it nine? I lost count. I already mentioned it with Lincoln's speech. As Patrick knows and any of the rest of you in this room who are historians, for the last generation, two generations really, we've been arguing in scholarship endlessly that what the American Civil War really is a second American Revolution. We had a first one in the late 18th century. In the 1860s, we had a second one. What is the Confederacy but a revolution? There are plenty of folks around who will still argue. I heard from some of them in the last 3 weeks at various places in the South. Although there are many different Souths, to be sure. I gave a talk in Charleston, South Carolina the other day, and there was just a room full of progressives. Nobody fussed over anything. It's quite disappointing. But, you know, there are plenty of people around who will still say, no, the Confederacy was a proper use of constitutional state sovereignty. They were merely acting in their own interest and in their right, under the 10th Amendment, I suppose, of state sovereignty, states' rights. Now, they were engaged in a revolution against the United States. If they had won, the Confederate States of America would have won a revolution. And, oh God, would we have a different history. But they didn't win. The North won. And because the war lasted as long as it did, it had to transform not just the South, but it had to begin to try, at least, to transform the very meaning of an American nation, because it had to figure out what to do with 4 million freed slaves. Who were they? What are they? What rights will they have? As soon as those questions are asked, this is a revolution. And it's unending. That's the part of this that's really unending. Actually, I think there are two, and I'll end with this. I mean, this isn't news to most of you, or you wouldn't be here tonight, but the legacies, the deepest legacies of our Civil War, and this came up in the back room when we were with the students, can be kind of lumped into two categories if you want. One of them is all about states' rights and federalism. The proper relationship, that balance that's in our system inherently, eternally, that we have to fight out and figure out, generation after generation. What is the proper relationship of state power to federal power? What do governments owe their people and people owe their governments? And we're living through, in case you haven't had both eyes open, an incredible revival of states' rights doctrine right now. In the Supreme Court, for sure, in the Congress, for sure, but primarily in state legislatures. The action in American politics is in state legislatures, especially the 36 controlled by the Republican Party. That's not a partisan comment. That's a fact. Hundreds and hundreds of bills have come up in Republican-controlled state legislatures for the past several years. They haven't all passed. Trying to bring power away from the federal government back to the states, often dealing with environmental protection or the Interstate Commerce Clause or health insurance and Obamacare. I lost count now. How many states still will not enforce the Medicare aid bills? The Medicare aid bill that came out of Congress will not extend Medicare in their own states because they exercise, they believe, the right of a state to determine its own health care system. Voting rights. What did we just do 2 years ago in the Supreme Court? 5-4 vote. Struck that clause out of the 65 Voting Rights Act, which gave the federal judicial, the federal Justice Department, the authority to judge any change in voting procedures or the right to vote in any of the former Jim Crow states. The states that had practiced for three generations explicit disfranchisement. John Roberts said, racism has eroded enough in the United States that we can get rid of that. And what did numerous state legislatures do within 3 months of that? Pass voter ID laws. Passed all kinds of ways to restrict the right to vote. Now, they never admit that that's what they're doing. They claim there's voter fraud out there. They can't find any. But we will always have this struggle between state power and federal power. But we're living through now an extended period of resistance to federal authority. I could go on and on about that. I'll try not to. I won't. And then, of course, on race. I mean, no, the situation in Baltimore is not a direct result of the Civil War. No, it's not a direct result of Reconstruction. I actually hate that when you're on the radio with some program and the guy says, so, what do you think Baltimore has to do with Reconstruction? You know, and you're supposed to answer that in 40 seconds. God. Well, nothing and maybe everything, you know. Or a guy in GBH in Boston, I won't name his name because he's a terrific radio host, did a program just a couple weeks ago in which he kept asking this question. And the way he would ask it was, so, and there were like three of us on, so, professors, when are we going to get over this race thing? And, God, and he knows better. But it's the radio announcer trying to be provocative and trying to get you to say something in a sound bite that, I don't know. But in the end, all I could say is, probably never. Sorry. I don't know where that light on the other side of the horizon actually is. And if anybody says they know, they're kidding you. They don't know. We don't know. And that's what I want to end on. I want to tell you a quick story. We'll just end with this. It's the story I used in American Oracle to end the book. It's the epilogue, and I'll tell it very quickly. So if you've read the epilogue of that book, apologies. But I bet you haven't. Ralph Ellison, the great African-American novelist who wrote the book Invisible Man and won all kinds of book prizes in, was it 1948, 49? Ellison became a very famous writer because of that book, and a great one. One of the great books we have about the problem of race in America, and about how the way black people to so much of white America in the 20th century had become essentially invisible. Underground. Ellison is in Rome in 1956. He's on a big fellowship at the American Academy in Rome, and he's staying in a fancy apartment above a beautiful piazza with a fountain, of course. It's Rome. And he went to sleep one night reading a book about classical tragedy, and he had a really bad dream. Now, we don't know if he really had the dream, because he's a very, very good artist. He's a good writer. But he wrote the story of his dream 9 years later. And note the date. He published a little essay. It's like an essay short story. You don't, if you read it, you don't quite know what category to put it in. He called it Tell It Like It Is, Baby. That's the title. And he published it in The Nation magazine in August of 1965. Note the date. Right after the Voting Rights Act had just passed. It was the 100th anniversary issue of The Nation magazine, a magazine some of you may know. It's a very short piece. The title comes from the fact that he had received a letter while in Rome from one of his old buddies in Oklahoma City. Ellison grew up in Oklahoma City, and he gets this letter from a friend named Virgil. And Virgil says to Ralph, he says, Ralph, old homeboy, he calls him. He said, I shouldn't use the words, but he says, you see what these crackers down here are doing about that Supreme Court decision? He means Brown v. Board, which just happened in 54. He says, Ralph, you see what they're doing here? I mean, this is crazy. What are they doing? He says, Ralph, tell it like it is, baby. What's going on? Now, Ellison, I don't know if he told Virgil what was going on. But what we do know is what Ralph wrote in 65. And here it is. He says he went to bed reading a book about classical tragedy. And he's having a dream. And in the dream, he's a little boy. He's walking down the street in Oklahoma City, and he sees a man out in front of him on the sidewalk, and it looks like his father. And if you read enough about Ellison, you realize his father died when he was 3, so he never knew his father. But he's dreaming up his father. He runs up to the man, and oh, it's not him. Too bad. He keeps walking, and he walks through the trolley train station, and he comes out the other side of the trolley. This is a little boy. He walks out the other side of the trolley station, and he walks by this big equestrian monument, he says. It's a Confederate monument. He doesn't name it, but that's what it was. And then he keeps walking, and then he says, all of a sudden, it was like a history picture book just fell out beneath me. And in the dream, he descends back in time to 1865, 100 years before. It's Washington, D.C. He's a little boy. He says he's a little slave boy. He's wearing a tunic. And he suddenly sees this crowd, this boisterous, terrible, screaming crowd out ahead of him. And in the middle of the crowd, there's a litter with a body on it. And they're carrying the litter. And they're screaming and they're hollering and they're drinking pails of beer. And somebody grabs him and they force him up to the litter and they make him carry it. And he says, I started to try to run away and they wouldn't let me run away. I started to try to scream and I couldn't scream. We've all had dreams like this. He says, I kept trying to cry and I couldn't cry. They wouldn't let me go. They wouldn't let me go. And then they find some more little black boys and little black girls in their tunics to come up and carry the litter. And he says, the crowd is beginning to desecrate the body. They're tearing the clothes off the body. And you very quickly realize you're at an alternative version of the funeral of Abraham Lincoln. It's Lincoln on the litter. And then the crowd keeps rolling and screaming and hollering. And it's laced with literary allusions, by the way. I don't know if you know the work of Edmund Wilson, the great literary critic who had just published his great book, Patriotic Gore. And most novelists and writers had at best a love-hate relationship with Edmund Wilson. But at one point, Ellison says, the guy out leading the band and leading the crowd was this man. He had a big pail of beer in his hand and he poured it on Lincoln's head. And he said, God, he looked just like Edmund Wilson. And the crowd keeps moving and keeps moving and keeps moving. And it's terrible. And they're beginning to desecrate the body itself. They finally reach the Washington Monument, and I'm leaving parts out. They reach the Washington Monument. They lay the litter on the ground. The crowd is screaming and dancing. And the little boy gets peeled up against the Washington Monument. He tries to run away. They won't let him run away. He tries to scream and he can't scream. He tries to cry and he can't cry. And then finally, the final scene of the dream. Oh, by the way, he says the body. They now begin to desecrate the body itself. They're tearing Lincoln's ears. They're tearing his fingers off. And he says the body began to bloat. Body began to bloat and bloat. And then it began to squirt juices at the crowd. I mean, it gets terrible. You want this damn story to end when you're reading. It's like the body's trying to fight back. And then the dream ends by the little boy says he sees this giant hole in the ground. They've moved the litter down into the ground. And there's this huge crowd gathered all around it like they're about to have a feast. And then slithering black birds fly over, which is probably something right out of Revelation. And he wakes up. And Ellison says that he was so unstable when he woke up from that nightmare. He was so disconcerted that the only way he could relax, he said, was to start reciting the Gettysburg Address, which he learned at Frederick Douglass High School in Oklahoma City. He said, I just kept reciting it, trying to relax, kept reciting it. And then he spends the last two pages of the little piece interpreting his own dream. And I won't go into it all, but essentially what Ellison says in that interpretation is that Americans don't know the wisdom of tragedy. They don't understand tragedy. They don't have a sufficient wisdom of tragedy. Now, I don't know precisely what Ellison was doing with that incredible little story, but the fact that he published it after these 9 years, if indeed he had that dream, but even if he hadn't had the dream, that he published it at that moment, that's the most triumphal moment of the Civil Rights Movement, the passage of the Voting Rights Act. When Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, and don't forget, Johnson had an important role in that, despite what that recent film said. When Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act and handed that pen to Martin Luther King, you can't find a more triumphal moment. But what is Ellison perhaps saying? When you win, or you think you've triumphed, watch out. Because history's still there. It's still happening. It probably is preparing to come back around and get you again. And that's probably what Baldwin meant. by his definition of tragedy. Know that your losses are coming. Know the past so that you'll be ready for it. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.